Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Mully and Hall, mornings live at 5 on Sports Radio 670 The Score. 670thescore.com, Chicago's sports station.
The clock winding down here in game two. The winning team in each of the first two games of this series put six on the board. And now it's a best two out of three series between the Blackhawks and the Oilers, who were a much different team tonight.
Not the start we wanted, without question. So we have a chance to maybe continue the frustration that they may have been feeling going into the game. And right away, they're feeling good and feeling they're turning it around. And their top players feeling confident. And then it's an uphill battle. And again, I thought some of our guys were really good, and they allowed us to stay in the game, but not enough of them.
Mully and Hall, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. Our thanks to NBC Sports Chicago, and of course, Jeremy Colleton. You heard him there. Thanks for the cut, and we are delighted to welcome in Charlie Roumeliotis. He joins us on the Al Pamonte Ford Hotline. Al Pamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Charlie, good morning. Thanks for jumping on. We appreciate it.
Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning. This wake-up call would have been much easier after a W, but we're here anyway.
You know, I don't want to sit here and blame Corey Crawford, and I understand that, you know, it takes a village, but I think we did feel that if Corey Crawford were to be able to be Corey Crawford, then the Blackhawks were going to win this series. There seemed to be that seemed to be the advantage that they were going to have in this series. And, you know, whether fair or not, it is a fact that he's allowed 10 goals in two games. And I don't know that we just blame him, but it's a very difficult task he's trying to perform here after coming off COVID-19 and showing up in the NHL bubble. But where are we at with evaluating Corey? And there is a lot there in terms of his future.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers obviously don't look great for Corey. And I think when you put everything into perspective and the fact that he missed the first 12 days of training camp and really had to ramp up in time for game one, I think he was honestly good enough in game one. Like, obviously, he wasn't very strong, but he was solid. Like, he came up big when he needed to. And I think yesterday was probably a game that they can, you know, the defense is usually turning around and looking at Corey Crawford like, we're going to need you tonight because we don't have it. And I don't think certainly Corey Crawford wasn't the primary reason why they lost last night. I thought that the Blackhawks just clearly didn't match the Oilers' intensity, even though they knew that it was coming. Like, we heard from Jeremy Colleton before the game saying we would be naive to think that they're not going to throw everything they have at us. And they did. And so the Blackhawks didn't match it, and they were basically playing catch-up all game.
Charlie, the best way to combat desperation, though, was execution, and the Hawks just didn't have it. So when you watched that game and you heard Jeremy Colleton afterwards say, we can't have any passengers, who do you think a couple guys he was referring to?
Well, I think it was a total team effort, obviously, in game one, where everything was clicking. The special teams, the power play, the top six lines. Whereas this one, you know, game two was obviously much different, where the first line wasn't going as much as it was in game one. Patrick Kane obviously looked like Patrick Kane last night, but he was double shifting. because Drake Cajula was out of the lineup and John Quinville only played about 3 minutes of hockey. And so the lines were a little bit disjointed, but I think the reality is the Blackhawks fell behind so quickly where it was 2-0 in the first 4 minutes, and then the Oilers get a power play. And I'm pretty sure on the bench they're like, all right, it's going to be this kind of game where we're going to have to just, you know, throw everything that we have, or we're going to have to try to match the intensity and basically throw away the script of what maybe the game plan was going into the game. So I think just from the very beginning, I think it was easy to look at game one and see, okay, the Oilers jumped out to a 1-0 lead 2.5 minutes in, but the Blackhawks struck really quickly after that and kind of changed the momentum of the game. But in this game, it, at no point did they feel like they had control.
It was fascinating to see Connor McDavid be under the pressure he was under. And I know that a writer out in Colorado talked about his personality deficit. And there was a rally behind him, and there was a lot of concern. But you had him on the ropes a little bit and under a lot of pressure. And, man, that was gone before you even realized the game. You know, a lot of people weren't even in their seats in their houses when he was already scoring and getting his second goal and the whole bit.
Yeah, those are not smart comments by that reporter, because I don't think you watch the Oilers and you think Connor McDavid is the problem. Like, that guy is going to go down as easily one of the best players ever in NHL history. And we saw it last night. Like, he obviously was not much of a factor at even strength in game one. All three of his points came on the power play, but you know, you knew that he was just not going to let the Oilers go down without a fight, especially in their own building as the number five seed. And there's a lot on the line for McDavid. And I thought he was probably the best player on the ice last night, and it was very noticeable. And I think the Blackhawks just didn't have an answer. And we spoke to Jonathan Toews afterwards in the video conference call, and he basically said, my focus this series is on Connor McDavid. And you know, his line needed to do a better job, and I think he was being a little bit hard on himself. But, you know, the reality is if they can't stop Connor McDavid or Leon Draisaitl, who hasn't even gotten going yet in this series, then the Blackhawks are going to have a problem.
Charlie, we would scrutinize Joel Quenneville between games, by adjustments and lineups and things, and he won three cups, so certainly we can do so with Jeremy Colliton. So moving into game three, what do you expect? Because replacing John Quenneville in the lineup – with when you looked at the move, or replacing Cajula with John Quenneville didn't make an impact, and I wondered if Sakura would have been a better move there, and I wonder if moving Dylan Strome out of the second line for Kirby Dach might be a move they consider. What do you expect in terms of moves with the lineup?
Yeah, I wonder how much of John Quenneville's ice time was the fact that Jeremy Colliton recognized right away that we're in a 2-0 hole. The Oilers had a power play right after that. So it was before the first TV timeout. The Blackhawks were already trailing by two, and they were very clearly being the flat-footed team. You know, Oilers were throwing everything at them. So, you know, maybe Jeremy Colliton sensed that, okay, this is a game where we can probably utilize Patrick Kane more and try to double shift and get him more. And in a way, it worked, because if he hadn't been double shifting, you know, the Kirby Dach and Alex DeBrincat and Patrick Kane line wouldn't have gotten put together or stayed together. That, I thought that was easily the best line of the game for the Blackhawks. So, but yeah, even Patrick Kane said afterwards that, you know, the Blackhawks are at their best when they're rolling four lines. And I think in game three, Drake Cajula, you know, he's really an underrated player, like, for the Blackhawks, because he does it all. He has skill, he has grit, and I think he complements Kirby Dach and Alex DeBrincat really well. And so I think just getting back to the four-line rotation in Game 3 is going to pay dividends, not necessarily what exactly Cajula's loss was in Game 2, just the fact that they can roll four lines.
Really enjoyed your opportunity to talk to Danny Wirtz, and you had some great questions there. You know, we talked a little bit earlier about the takeaways in terms of Stan Bowman and Jeremy Colliton and everything else. What did you learn in that conversation, Charlie?
Yeah, it was a fun conversation, Pat Boyle and I, on the Blackhawks Talk podcast. And I think it was just a cool opportunity for fans to honestly hear and hear Danny Wirtz for the first time. And obviously you can read the transcription and, you know, kind of, you know, read it in your own words in your head. But actually hearing how he presented himself, and it really felt like Blackhawks fans should be confident that he's going to be more engaged And even if it's not in an informal role, he said he's going to be more engaged with the organization going forward. And I think that's good news for the Blackhawks because he really does seem like he has a good pulse on the direction of the franchise, but also in on the business side of things when it comes to digital.
Charlie, it's hard for me to envision somebody being more hands-on than John McDonough was. So I guess does when you say he's going to be involved in every aspect, in how was he going to do that? And did his vote of confidence for Stan Bowman strike you as a surprise given what the Hawks have done and haven't done in recent seasons?
Yeah, I think it's still a question to be answered is how they're going to restructure or structure the hockey operations department, because obviously he did give Stan Bowman that vote of confidence that he has and confirmed that Stan has a multi-year contract and that they are going to honor that. And seeing it firsthand behind the scenes, how the Blackhawks operate, I think was important to him to kind of see what goes into those decisions. And, you know, the one question obviously we all have is how the Blackhawks are going to structure their hockey operations department. Are they going to have a business side that takes care of that? And then a president of hockey operations, like some of the teams such as Vegas have separated with George McPhee and Kelly McCrimmon. So, you know, I don't know. And I thought it was interesting though, that they're going to put everything in place first. And then that's kind of going to be the last domino to fall at the last hire, which could take a while, like even go into next season, which I thought was very interesting because usually, you know, you might want to give the president some say on how things are run, but it sounds like they want to get everything else in order first. And then that's going to be the last piece.
Back to stuff on the ice here. So we saw the adjustment, which was the Oilers came out as the desperate team and played a lot better and scored early, and McDavid took over the series, basically. What's the counter move? What does Jeremy Colliton have to do? What does he have to instill for Game 3?
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily a lineup move, but I would like to see the Blackhawks score the first goal in Game 3 and maybe not feel like they're playing behind from behind or have to play catch-up. I think it would be nice of the Blackhawks to kind of establish control right off the hop, and maybe if Corey Crawford can get a few big saves in him early on to kind of get that confidence that he still can be the Corey Crawford of old. And he just needs to see pucks, and he needs to get those reps in. And I think once the Blackhawks do that, and obviously their power play was phenomenal in Game 1, and I thought they really had solid looks in Game 2, but they just couldn't cash in, so I wouldn't be too concerned in that area. You know, just score the first goal, you know, let Corey Crawford get into some sort of rhythm early on and maybe see where that takes you.
What did you make of the complaints over communication you heard from a couple guys? There was no crowd noise. It was just you're in that environment. Was it just a matter of inexperience, or what did you make of that, Charlie?
Yeah, I think that's a little bit overblown because both sides are going through that. I think what the reality was is the fact that both of the teams are dealing with the fact that there is no crowd noise. So when you're trying to communicate with a player, the opposing team can hear you. And so you have to really communicate non-verbally. And, you know, but that wasn't an issue in Game 1. So if the Blackhawks lose in Game 2, we can't make it an issue in Game 2.
Charlie, great stuff. Appreciate your time.
Take a
Thanks,
nap.
Guys. Appreciate it. I will.
Yeah. You deserve one. Thanks,
Quick
Charlie.
Turnaround.
Yeah, that. What time did that game end? After midnight.
12:05.
Right?
Yeah, earlier
wow.
this morning.
Not that you were checking the clock or anything.
No, I was like, "What time is it? Are you kidding me? I love hockey."
Yeah. No. I got to tell you, the fact of the matter is that once you start watching it, I don't know how you turn it off. I mean, I can understand falling asleep in front of it if you're that wrecked, but how
hypnotic.
Do you walk away? Yeah.
You can't.
There's no way.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's too much fun, too. And this is – I mean, you want to talk about a sprint of a series. My God, a five-game series. It just seems like we're finally clearing our throats here. And now here comes, you know, critical Game 3, right? The winner of Game 3. Those Hawks were 82% likely to win. Now what are they? I mean, it's just crazy.
I don't know what the math is, but both teams are bad enough defensively that you don't want to get up off the couch.
Can happen at any minute. It's Mully and Haw. 367-67 Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
I'm probably going to be a little biased here. I just don't think that we've handled this since the beginning very well. I don't think what Manfred's done for the sport has been very good. I don't think the way that everything was publicly humiliated was good. I just don't think it's been good. And I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed as a player to watch this take place because, you know, when I leave this game, I want to leave it for the generations, and we do this for the fans. And there was just so much – there's just been so much distraction and so much hidden agendas in all these discussions that it's almost been just embarrassing, like I said. I don't know any other way to put it.
Wow, that's a pretty good way to put it. That is Stephen Souza there, Stephen Souza Jr. from the Cubs, and he was on with Tiki and Tierney on CBS Radio, and he did not pull any punches regarding the responsibility that one Rob Manfred — he's not a man, he's not a Fred, he's Manfred. Wow. I mean, he really does not, he goes right after him. There's no shadow of a doubt how he feels on that one.
No ambiguity there. No. He certainly — you wonder if he's speaking on behalf of most of the players, a majority of Major League Baseball, in their frustration over the way this has been handled and some of the inconsistencies. And you wonder where it is headed, Mully, because what we've seen here is you've got two teams that have been affected the most by this, with what we would refer to as outbreaks. And the Cardinals still stuck in Milwaukee, as we talked about. They've got their postponed series with the Tigers, moving them now to Friday as the next day against the Cubs. And you've got the Marlins, who are spending 22 days on the road because of the outbreak affecting their team. And you wonder what this does to the competitive balance.
I don't put this in the nightmare category.
When does it fall into the nightmare category if you continue to postpone games?
Yeah, everything he says, including his kind of tough guy, I'm not a quitter act, it just rings hollow. I'm sorry. It is I don't want to just attack the guy, but I've got to tell you, it's hard not to. I mean, it's hard not to feel like he's the guy responsible for a lot of the problems they've had, and they rushed a lot of things and they put off a lot of things in the whole nine yards.
It does feel that way. And I think it feels that way because he continues to not fully explain himself or provide more clarity. And I think when you see officials in anything, like whether it's your team or a league or whatever, the lack of transparency, it makes you more suspicious probably. And Rob Manfred hasn't answered questions from the baseball media in a long time. He has issued statements. He has done interviews, hand-chosen interviews with people who he has wanted to talk to, but he hasn't opened himself up to the kind of impromptu questioning that you would hope that he would, so he could address some of these things.
Yeah, I agree with you. I just think that, you know, we are still kind of sitting on pins and needles here with this season. It seemed like we were fearful that things weren't going to take place. And now, as you say, the Cardinals are sitting there in Milwaukee and the White Sox show up and they get to play against a team that did not have a chance to play for a few days. And by the way, lost Lorenzo Cain because he opted out, and Ryan Braun is hurt. So, you know, you sit there and you want to say fantastic victory, unbelievable comeback, great work, and all of that is true. But you also benefited a little bit from the circumstances of the game and from the players that were not available as much as those that were. And I know Avi tried to win that game by himself, but I'll tell you what, it's good there is no Lorenzo Cain or no Ryan Braun. It might have been a different story.
And by the same token, you look ahead at the Cubs, who will go into St. Louis, scheduled to on Friday, and the Cardinals, it will have been like 9 days between games for them, and you wonder who is going to be affected. What will the roster look like? They have not added players to it yet, but they'll be without probably seven at last count, and you wonder how that will affect the race in that division, because the Cardinals are more contenders than the Marlins are, and certainly the Brewers were more competitive with Lorenzo Cain. So all these things do affect, Rob Manfred, the competitive integrity of your season. So everything about this season feels very, very tentative.
What is the ultimate outcome here, David, in terms of, are we looking now at winning percentage? Does it matter, like, how many games you're winning right now? The Cubs seem to be building a lead that is, you know, in this kind of shortened season is quickly becoming one that's going to be hard to catch. How do you expect this to happen? Because, frankly, if you're leaving teams playing doubleheaders for the rest of the season, that's going to be awful hard, too, from a competitive advantage standpoint.
The Cubs, if you do the math, have the equivalent of a 21-5 start in ordinary circumstances over a 162-game season. That's a hot team. And you think that they probably are less affected by this if that continues by the winning percentage. Some teams may benefit by playing fewer games. That there's no question about that. But it just doesn't have any sort of consistency. I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know how many more times we're going to face cancellations and postponements. So what is the minimum number of games that a team has to play before you consider it, you know, a legitimate representation of your season? Is it 50? Is it 55? There are some teams that aren't going to play 55 games based on the first week and a half of the season, right? That's not going to be realistic.
Right. No, I
so
that's the point.
Then yeah. What?
Yeah, I listen. I mean, you're absolutely right. I don't know then what. I don't know the answer to that.
It is very hard to figure, but if what happened to the Marlins, I can't help but wonder this, and I think a lot of people have expressed this as well, but had that been the Yankees or the Dodgers
yeah.
or the Cubs or a team in a major market that has realistic playoff aspirations, I wonder how that would have been handled by Major League Baseball. Instead, you have the Marlins, who many people couldn't tell you the difference between the players they're adding, who Don Mattingly has yet to meet, and the players they're doing without, because the Marlins are not a marquee team that had aspirations and realistic chance to compete this year. Had that been different, I wonder if the commissioner would have responded in a more, I guess, responsible way, or been more responsive overall to what was going on.
The Marlins have played 3 games. Okay, we're talking about 10 games for the teams here in town. They played 3 games. They're 2-1. Right now, they sit atop the NL East with a .667 winning percentage. All they've got to do is not play again, and they're in the playoffs.
Maybe Derek Jeter is a genius after all.
Yeah, they're going to enter the playoffs with a 4-2 record. You know, We heard from Derek Jeter yesterday. What did you think about his blanket denial? And he pushed back a little bit at this idea that the Marlins were getting heat for going out and clubbing in Atlanta. And he said that, no, they were just going out for coffee and clothes and maybe a dinner here or there. And so it's very difficult to blame them, come down too hard because of what they were doing.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. He says that basically they didn't have enough information. Basically, you know, there was overconfidence and people didn't know enough. Well, I mean, who I wonder if we know anyone that might have been able to tell them about what's happening and how to behave and all that. I marvel at people that sort of, you know, what happened was there was an overconfidence by everyone. No, there shouldn't have been. You should have told them, hey, tighten this up. We can't be going out. We got to be extra secret probation here. You know, be careful, regardless
like
of anything else.
Like it is now.
Yes.
You know, like they have now responded to tightening things up, where it sounds very restrictive under the new protocol. But you do wonder if this was part of the discussion prior to the season and if there was pushback on the Players Association, something we'll probably never know,
right,
Molly. But was this maybe somebody on Major League Baseball's side wanting to be a little bit more stringent, and somebody on the Players Association side saying they'll never go for that? And look what happened now, both with the Marlins and the Cardinals. The Cardinals pushed back as well because of the reports from our guy John Heyman and Jerry Hairston Jr. on that on their podcast that they had gone to a casino. They
yes.
denied that. They flatly denied that report. And I wonder what their mindset is, because you know, that didn't just come out of, you know, that
thin
didn't
air.
Just
yeah.
Thin air, yeah. I don't know where that one's headed either, but the bottom line is players are going to have to, you know, be relative hermits on the road when they travel or risk kind of sort of, you know, exposing themselves or maybe discipline.
Let's take a listen to that, because that is very interesting from Jerry Hairston Jr.
If you see my tweet, I didn't really, you know, go in. I just touched on a couple things. The reason why I did that, I was urged by a couple people that are in the game. Hey, please get this out here. Please get this out here. You know what I'm saying? Because they're going to shut us down. And I think it was, you know, from the people that wanted me to tweet that out, you know, I felt I was more defending the teams that were doing things the right way that want to continue right. to play. I don't want to see the Cardinals get in trouble. I don't want to see the Marlins get in trouble. I want them to be okay. I want their families to be okay. I want their grandparents to be okay. You know what I'm saying? It's just kind of like a wake-up call. It was more of a tweet to defend the people that are doing things the right way and to kind of shake the Marlins and the Cardinals. Hey, man, they may shut us down. You know, let's act like the other 28 teams, do a mini bubble. You know, you can't do like the NBA. You just can't. There's way too many people. But you can do is do the very best job you can. That means hotel, stadium, home. That's it.
And that's it. And that, of course, Jerry Hairston Jr., and he was on the Big Time Baseball podcast. You can get that on radio.com. Our buddy John Heyman. A lot there, David, but I think that people are starting to understand that they have to. I think the Cubs have gotten it all along. I don't think that I personally think it's because of what they saw Tommy Hotovy go through. I think that was a shockwave through not just the pitching staff, but probably through the entire team. And I think that, you know, they're older dudes and more mature, and, you know, Chris Bryant, you know, obviously having his first child. I think there's a lot of extenuating circumstances, but I think they've done a great job and have been very mature and lifted each other up. And I think other teams didn't do this seriously.
They were professional. Definitely is a combination of the experience you referenced and the firsthand account from their pitching coach, a guy who was the picture of health. And if he can get it, we can get it. And I think that mindset is what prevented them from doing anything that would put them in jeopardy. And they have had more success than any team in baseball in terms of the testing process, because everything is in place. So you got to give them credit and hope that it continues.
All right, we've got Mike Florio to join us next. Mike will come on. We'll ask him about the NFL setting their opt-out date at 3:00 Chicago time on Thursday, right? So it is Tuesday. You got a couple days to think about it, NFL, and decide whether you're in or you're out. We'll run that by Mike next. It's Mully and Haw on The Score.
670 The Score is Chicago sports. And for nearly three decades, Chicago sports is 670 The Score. Chicago's number one sports station in 1992. And still number one today. A radio.com sports station. This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago sports station.
The opening bell brought to you by CarX Tire and Auto.
FootballTalk.com, NBC Sports, Twitter.com/ProFootballTalk.
Hey, buddy! Hey, buddy! We get better and better!
We get better and better!
We get
BB! NFL Insider, Mike Florio.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 6-7 of The Score. We love our opportunity to talk to Mike Florio. He joins us on the L. Pamonte Ford Hotline, Al Pamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Good morning, Michael. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
You know, we're wondering about the opt-out thing and the fairness of that and the idea. I get it. They probably have more guys that are opting out than they imagined initially. But, Mike, I mean, don't we need as much information as possible? For instance, the baseball season, shouldn't players be able to kind of monitor what happens there? Now it's Thursday at 3:00 Chicago time, 4:00 Eastern time. You've got to decide whether you're in, you're out. Is that fair?
You know, I'm looking at the final document right now that we obtained outlining all of the various procedures, and it is a tight window, Thursday, August 6th, with two exceptions. If a player gets a qualifying diagnosis for a higher risk category at some point after August 6th, he'll have 1 week to opt out. If he gets that diagnosis, diabetes, et cetera, or if a family member is hospitalized or dies from COVID-19 at that point, he'll have another window to opt out. I personally believe that the player should have two other automatic limited windows to consider opting out. And that would be at some point after they put the pads on and begin practicing 11 on 11 and sweating and spitting and bleeding and coughing on each other in practice. And then at some point after the season starts and they get a chance to see what it feels like to play in a game, what it feels like to travel, what it feels like to be out there going against opponents that you haven't been around for the last 6 weeks. And you don't know which of those guys are being careful and which ones may be carrying the virus. And that guy may be lining up right across from you. And they're not going to know how they feel until they get in that situation. So I have been a believer from the get-go that, you know, I have no problem with baseball's approach where you can tap out or tap back in whenever you want. The NFL wants something more rigid than that. I'm a firm believer in the idea that after the pads are on and after the games start, all players should have another chance to opt out. And I will say this, for the players who don't have a significant signing bonus repayment obligation, and a lot of players are operating under contracts with no signing bonus that is owed back to the team at all if they would walk away, they could always retire after August 6th, and then they could unretire. We learned that 12 years ago with Brett Favre. So that's an ace in the hole that a player has if he wakes up middle of September, has played a game, and says, you know, it was fine when we were all sequestered in the facility and we were social distancing and wearing masks and, you know, walking through these sanitizer spray things that the Broncos have. But now that we're playing games, I don't feel as good about it. I'm just going to walk away. Players could always retire if they wouldn't owe a bunch of money back to the team for doing so.
I couldn't agree more, Mike. I don't know why there's such a rigid approach to this. You need some flexibility given the times that we all live in. I wonder how much of this is because teams are responding to agents who were trying to use the threat of opting out as leverage to get new contracts.
Yeah, it's a holdout without consequence. That's the problem. And I heard two reasons why the NFL wanted to change the deadline for opting out. It was supposed to be 1 week after the agreement revising the CBA was signed. So it would have been next Monday, the 10th of August. Instead, it's Thursday, the 6th. Not a huge difference when we're considering that these other windows aren't going to be in play. But the teams were irritated by the fact that players who can sense that they're going to be asked to bring their playbook and go to the coach's office at some point and not make the 53-man roster were opting out and taking the stipend. And I've asked the league if there is a repayment obligation. If you come back next year and you don't make the 53-man roster, do you have to pay that money back? There isn't a clear answer that I've found yet in the official document, which tells me there isn't an obligation to pay it back. And the other situation was this idea of an agent saying to the team, hey, my guy's thinking about opting out if you don't give him a new contract. And, you know, I don't want to be overly cynical about that. I think for some players, it could be a factor. If you're Dalvin Cook and you're looking at a $1.3 million salary and you believe you've already outperformed that contract, you believe you deserve to be compensated, just like Kirk Cousins, Mike Zimmer, and Rick Spielman have all been in Minnesota after they managed to beat the Saints in the wild card round. I think a win that delivered all of those contracts, and you're Dalvin Cook and you haven't gotten yours yet, and you have concerns about playing in a pandemic. I mean, all of those factors go into the same stew. It's not a simple yes or no. You know, I may not be interested in playing football this year for $1.3 million, but if you're going to give me the contract that I think I've earned, I'll take on that extra risk of playing in a pandemic. I mean, that's a legitimate position some guys may take. The NFL wasn't comfortable with guys having the opportunity to hold that over their heads. That's why they wanted to slam the door as early as they could.
Mike, the revised CBA is finally done. What was the holdup there? I thought that had been agreed upon a while ago.
Well, they reached the agreement 11 days ago, but then they had to reduce it to writing. I also have that document in front of me here, too. I haven't studied it yet. It is 13 pages long, which makes me wonder why it did take so long to get it done. I think what happened is they continued to haggle. They continued to go back because nothing's done until it's officially done, right? So they reach a tentative agreement And the tentative agreement gets everyone in camp. It gets the players to quit sounding off on social media about their concerns. And then the players are focused more on getting ready for the season, not giving the NFL a hard time for not giving the players what they want. Now, the thinking is the players did pretty well with this, you know, especially because they wiped out the preseason. But, you know, I've got this. I just got this thing while we were on the air earlier, and I'm going to take a careful look at it. But it's 13 pages, and it's got all the chapter and verse information in there. But, you know, one of the things they continued to negotiate on after the fact was this opt-out window. And my understanding is the NFLPA got concessions from the league to agree to reduce it from 7 days to 3 days. I don't know what the concession is, and I doubt that the document's going to make that clear. But that's part of the negotiation that still continued even after the deal was supposedly done.
Mike, what's your best guess at why there are 8 Patriots who just have decided to opt out? It seems like a high number when you compare it to the rest of the league.
Well, I'm a firm believer in Occam's razor. And in this setting, the simplest explanation is that they could use a break from Bill Belichick for a year. I feel like some of these guys, when you consider that they've won 1, 2, or 3 Super Bowls, and a lot of them have made their money, and you know, there's a ton of factors that go into the soup, and you know, maybe they just could use a break from Belichick. Now look, other guys have specific family concerns, but those are one of the factors as well. I mean, for some guys, you find a way to work around it. You self-isolate within your home. If you have family members you're concerned about, there's things you can do. And I'm being half facetious and half serious about it, but, you know, when we see this exodus from Tom Brady and Rob Gronkowski, Gronkowski retired to get away from Belichick. I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe they just think it's going to be even more stressful this year trying to do everything that Bill Belichick expects you to do every minute of every day, and you throw the stress of worrying about the pandemic on top of it. I mean, it's so many at this point that it feels like it's not just some random aberration. And I think it's funny that people think that Belichick is the one who's the puppet master on this. That's ridiculous that he would be doing this. What's his end game? What's his strategy for having 8 guys opt out? That makes no sense. But that just shows you how deeply he's inside the heads of all of his opponents around the league. They assume that anything that happens with the Patriots is the product of some overall strategy that Bill Belichick has devised.
When you think of Pete Carroll, you don't say, well, you know, Father Flanagan of NFL receivers. But then again, there's probably desperate need to get some receivers into Seattle, so he's open to anything.
Well, last year they were looking both at Josh Gordon and Antonio Brown. The problem was, for Brown, there was that vague sense that if he signed with a team, he'd be put on the commissioner exempt list, so whoever signs him ends up paying him to not play. That cloud is now gone, even though the incident that had teams fearing he'd be placed on the commissioner exempt list still isn't fully resolved. The NFL has not closed the door on its investigation of the civil lawsuit against Brown for sexual assault and rape. They have not been able to reach any conclusions, but because the civil lawsuit is still going forward, I think they want to keep the door open to potentially change their mind if, for example, there would be a trial and a verdict from a jury in a civil action, which is a lower standard of proof that Antonio Brown did something he shouldn't have done. But for now, 8-game suspension, free and clear after that. And if he can play like he did when we last saw him on a field in 2018, well, we saw him for 1 week in 2019, and he wasn't bad with the Patriots. I mean, he can help a team. And you've got Russell Wilson, who's been jostling for some star power on that team, and you could probably get Antonio Brown fairly cheap if there aren't a lot of teams clamoring to get him. I think it just makes sense, whether it's Josh Gordon or Antonio Brown. It's kind of like whichever guy's available first is the guy that's going to get that offer to join the Seattle Seahawks. And I think Pete Carroll is being noncommittal because there's a chance Gordon's going to be cleared to come back before Antonio Brown serves his 8-game suspension.
Mike, you can't play the NFL season in a bubble, but are there lessons to be learned from what's happened with Major League Baseball?
Well, there are definitely lessons, which is make sure your guys take it seriously, because it sounds like some of the players on the Marlins didn't and some of the Cardinals didn't. And I think what we're going to see, because this is one that I was intrigued by. Peter King had some comments yesterday from Saints coach Sean Payton about how they've set up a sequestration in training camp where they have all the players and coaches and other key personnel staying in a hotel. And my first reaction was, well, how are you able to compel your players to stay away from home for 4 weeks as they get ready for the regular season? And what's to stop a team from doing that going into the regular season and creating their own hardened bubble where no one leaves? The practice facility, hotel, practice facility, hotel, pack it up and go on the road for a game and minimize the chances of someone getting infected by being at home, either because they're doing things they shouldn't do or because family members are infected or other people who come into the house are infected. And the NFL told me that this is voluntary. It's not mandatory, that what the Saints are doing is completely voluntary. Makes me wonder whether or not the Saints or other teams are going to continue it into the regular season. And I think it's fascinating that, you know, and think about it, voluntary workouts, they're voluntary, but how many people don't show up for them? If you create in a given team this atmosphere where the team leaders, the coaches, the executives are all choosing to stay in a hotel all season long, most of the other guys are going to do the same thing. Do you want to be the one guy that's going home at night and showing up the next day and getting the stink eye from your teammates because you're the one who's breaking this bubble, who's breaking this quarantine? So, you know, I've been a big advocate of hardening the bubbles around the various teams, that I think that increases the chances of getting the games played. I think that we may just see it kind of happen on a de facto basis where teams willing to spend the money and teams willing to push the envelope are going to set it up. And those teams are probably going to be less likely to have a bunch of key players on the COVID-19 list when the games start.
Mike, thanks a ton. Great catching up with you. Really appreciate it as always.
All right, guys. Take
care.
Mike.
That is Mike Florio. Always a joy to talk to him. And we want to thank everyone for calling and texting and emailing.
Most of all, thank you for listening today.
Yeah, we certainly appreciate that. Always a joy. Listen, want to thank our executive producer, Mr. Dustin Rhodes.
He ended up with carpal tunnel.
And of course, we want to thank Kevin Zipak for his hard work.
Return to normalcy.
And don't forget to thank Ray. Ray, you move us. You move us deeply.
Thanks, Ray.
Cobra virus.
Shahid of Sharma is going to be on with Dan Bernstein to talk some Cubs at 10 a.m. So make sure you stay tuned. David, enjoy yourself. Have a great day. A lot of fun today.
Have a great day, Mully.
Get some sleep, buddy. I'm going to be all watching right. Man United. I got other plans.
I'll take a nap. That'll put me to sleep.
There you go. That'll get you. It's Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 6-7 of the score.
Segment brought to you by Aloha Restoration. Get your home bone dry in no time.
End the story.
I see you soon, baby.
If it is to be said, so it be. So it is.
Chicago baseball is hot right now. With both the Cubs and Sox out to a fast start, count on the score for the most comprehensive coverage of both sides of town.
It's got a chance. Cubs win.
Robert slices a ball to right center field. Starling back at the wall. It is gone.
Keep it here for the hottest Cubs and Sox talk throughout the season. We are Sports Radio 670 The Score, Chicago Sports Station.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.